Welcome back to this Tuesday's Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark, and I'm joined, as always, by the award-winning Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post, Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
It's been a weekend.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and nontroversies, can we blame fandom for the rise of Donald Trump? That is what legendary comic book writer and novelist Alan Moore suggested in The Guardian last week, relitigating an argument from a decade ago in which he suggested that the rise of the comic book blockbuster suggested a sort of stunted adulthood that proved fertile ground for fascist thinking. I'm a little bit skeptical of this argument, as well as this other one about fandom, just for reasons that are fairly simple, and maybe we can get into them. But, like, basically every genre of filmmaking, from the Western to the cop movie to the horror film, has been decried as fascist at some point. I'm not totally sure I buy that, unless we want to say the art of cinema as a you know, whole has contributed to this. But before working out, before talking about that, let's talk about Moore's piece here. In it, he kind of writes about his own relationship to fandom as a kid growing up in the 1960s. He attended some of the earliest comic book conventions in England before they went corporate. You know, he loved the fanzine scene. He got to see the birth of, you know, kind of a more useful sort of fandom, as he described it. And then he gets to the meat of the argument. Here's a quote from him. Quote, "And when I looked back after an internet and some few decades, fandom was a very different animal, an older animal for one thing, with a median age in its late 40s, fed presumably by a nostalgia that its energetic predecessor was too young to suffer from. And while the vulgar comic story was originally proffered solely to the working classes, soaring retail prices had precluded any audience save the more affluent, had gentrified a previously bustling and lively cultural slum neighborhood. This boost in fandom's age and status possibly explains its current sense of privilege, its tendency to carp and cavil rather than contribute or create." End quote. The encroachment of fandom into all aspects of life has had disastrous consequences for all of us. Here's Moore again. Quote, "Elections that decide the fate of millions are conducted in an atmosphere more suited to evictions on I'm a Celebrity, in which contestants who are insufficiently amusing are removed from office. Salability, not substance, is the issue. Those who vote for Donald Trump or Boris Johnson seem less moved by policy or prior accomplishment than by how much they've enjoyed the performances on The Apprentice or Have I Got News for You." End quote. Now, I'm a little torn on this, at least in part because I think Moore is extrapolating from his own bad experiences with fandom, both as a consumer and a creator of comics, to make a broader argument than strictly speaking applies. And look, we all do this all the time. We're all, like, struck by, I dealt with jerks on Twitter, and that's what's ruining the country. I dealt with jerks at the post office. That's what's ruining the country. That's a thing we all do. And I do think that there is an element of unhinged fandom in modern electoral politics, but political parties have always felt kind of like fandoms to a certain extent. There's always been a rally around the flag effort when your guy is attacked, right? A desire to defend even bad people and policies if they have a D or an R, whichever one you share next to their name. Also, just what Moore is describing here really is the celebrityification of modern politics, if we can use a fake word there. Guys like Donald Trump and Boris Johnson aren't polls so much as celebs, right? There is an element of toxic fandom in modern celebrity worship, for sure, right? You see it with Beyonce, Taylor Swift. Anytime one of their releases receives less than unanimous adulation, you see it all over the place in all sorts of fandoms. Toxic fandom in the world of comic books and nerd culture more frequently manifests in demands for stagnation, right? They want things to stay the same. They want what they grew up with to be the thing. They want Peter Parker to be Spider-Man forever, right?
Yeah, they want people to not be using AI.
that's a different topic. I'm trying to do a non-AI cons and nons for once. If we could maybe do that, that would be great. Whatever else Trump has done, he is not stagnant. He's not demanding Republican stagnation, right? His Republican Party is weak on national defense. It's pro-tariff. It's anti-immigrant. He's personally pro-choice, though that kind of manifests itself in odd ways elsewhere in the party. Alyssa, I guess this is my opening question. Is the rise of Trump a demonstration of toxic fandom or just a more general celebrity culture problem? Or is this just even a distinction without a difference? Is it all kind of merging and melding into the same thing?
Well, I think that I want to approach this from a slightly different direction, because I think that the relationship to a fan to sort of object of fanaticism is inappropriate for sort of voters and politicians in a free society, right? I mean, fans owe their objects of affection sort of adulation. And, you know, that is not – the power relationship is supposed to flow the other way in a democracy, right? Like, the politicians are supposed to owe us something in exchange for their votes. And so what I find troubling about the rise of fan-like behavior in politics, which I think has arguably become more intense, even if there were always sort of rally around the flag efforts, is that there is a subservience inherent in the sort of fan to object of worship relationship that is just unsuitable. Like, it is inappropriate for voters in a democratic society to feel that they owe anything to the people that they are electing. It really should be the other way. And that sort of habit, that subservient habit of mind, is something that I find troubling. And I think, to be clear, I think this is a kind of behavior that we see a lot on the left as well on the right. I mean, the sort of culture around Obama was, you know, the sort of dig on Obama is like, oh, he's a celebrity, not a politician. And he was treated that way, right? And it's sort of telling that his post-presidency has almost entirely been sort of lived out in, like, Hollywood and the publishing world and the podcasting world. Hillary Clinton certainly was the object of that kind of attention. Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Like, there's been a long sort of fanification of Democratic politics that became less consequential because their objects of worship left the stage or, you know, shifted to doing other things, right? Like, Michelle Obama is campaigning, but she's also, like, selling inspirational books and doing, like, sort of conferences and TV stuff. Like, she's basically become Oprah, who occasionally campaigns. You know, Barack Obama stopped being president. Like, he stopped running for president. And so, you know, the fandom for those figures got kind of channeled off into, you know, sort of commercial pursuits. Hillary Clinton, like, pops up periodically. Like, she does interviews, she writes books. But she is not sort of constantly on the road as a touring act. And so that energy got sort of rechanneled, shifted to another object of worship. But that sense that you have sort of an obligation to show up and show continued fealty and, you know, be the best fan, be the most uncritical fan, is just really unbecoming for Americans, for anyone who participates in a democracy. And that's where I think Moore is onto something, at least a little bit.
Well, and I do think, Peter, that you see some of that reaction to Donald Trump. He is often described. What's the line? He could shoot a guy on Fifth Avenue and his fans wouldn't care. I do think there is a certain amount of that kind of fanatical.
Well, and selling
worship.
The merch and the junk and the sort of J6 prison choir and the sort of quasi tent revival of it all, right? Like, he is, you know. The policy truly doesn't matter. He's just selling a cultural experience or a quasi-religious one.
Yeah, yeah. Peter, what do you make of Moore's argument?
So I thought this was interesting because it reflected in some unusual ways some of the stuff that I was already seeing online elsewhere. But actually, I want to go back to some of my very earliest experiences on the internet. So I am the right age where I was not online in any capacity until I was, I think, 13 or 14. And I wasn't really online with any kind of regularity until about the age of 15 or so. And The first stuff that I did online was that I went to the websites of the bands and the record labels that I was a big fan of. And then I started going to the websites that were made by other people who were big fans. So what I was seeing was nascent fan culture online. I was participating in it, and just mainly as somebody who's sort of viewing stuff. But what I was getting access to was that the serious fans were not just looking at a band's website. They weren't just looking at the record label website and seeing what was coming next, you know, sort of from the label. They were creating their own secondary culture based on this. And that was the mark of sort of serious fandom. And that's always been, right? Whether you're going to a con, in some ways, going to even just a meetup of a dozen folks in your neighborhood or your city is in some ways creating a secondary culture. It is participating, is building a community. It is making stuff in some cases. Alyssa mentioned all of the Trump merch. And with Trump, we really see that there is a fandom. And my understanding is, so I follow some folks who I find who I strongly disagree with online, but who I sort of follow in order to see what they're saying and how they're conversing with each other. And it was before I saw this Alan Moore piece, I was reading a conversation amongst a bunch of pro-Trump folks, some anonymous accounts mostly, but who were saying, look, I know that the polls are basically tied, but just look anywhere. The vibes are so pro-Trump, and you can just tell if you're looking at TikTok, if you're looking at all of these other, you know, Reddit, if you're looking at all of the social media conversations, anything that's going on X. I want to be clear, this is not a view I am endorsing. This is one I encountered that I have been thinking about because I don't know what to make of it. And one of the comments that came back was, yeah, this time is different. And the reason that it's different this time was that there is a fandom for Trump. And there is a fan culture out there. And I think that this is not the first time there has ever been a fan culture around a politician. But I do think it's more intense and more naturally sort of a product of the way the internet turns people into hyper fans by giving them the tools to create these online communities, and then also to create stuff, whether it's videos that, you know, in support or sort of memeable things that you can share, whether it's merch that you can just put up and sell, right? There's a ton. I've not been to a Trump rally. I have seen a lot of videos from Trump rallies, seen a lot of coverage. I think probably we all have. You know, this is the thing that happens that we end up seeing as part of our lives and our jobs. You look at any of the coverage and you just see a huge amount of merch. Most of that is not coming directly from the Trump campaign. Most of that is being produced on a secondary basis by Trump entrepreneurs, MAGA grifters, by super fans, by this sort of consortium of people who are there to prop up their guy. And that is that it does. Again, I don't want to say this is entirely new. I think Alyssa drawing us back to Obama and the cult of celebrity around him is totally correct. At the same time, the internet was still kind of developing back then. I mean, when Obama, you know, was first started running, I remember writing stories about social media, you know, the candidate social media at like Obama versus Romney on Facebook, and the numbers of like likes and follows that they were getting back then were just trivial. They were like the kinds of things, I mean, they were low hundreds or thousands. And I guess I'm not totally sure what to make of this, but I do think there is a kind of internet fan culture that has developed around Trump in particular, but American politics more generally over the past 15 years is so much of our sort of cultural discourse and life and community has moved online. And to go back to something that we've talked about pretty recently, there's a writer named Catherine D who writes the Default Friend Substack newsletter. And one of her precepts is sort of the ways that she treats the world is that basically everything in life is downstream from fandom. Maybe this is a little bit overstated, but I think there's some real truth to this, especially for people who are, let's say, under 35 or 40, who have more or less grown up online, who, you know, were there by the time they were teenagers or earlier, and whose experience of the online world is totally mediated by all this experience of culture, period, and politics, period, is totally mediated by these kind of weird online communities that do a huge amount to be that are like in some ways intentionally inscrutable to outsiders. On the other hand, also build these strong connections by being a little bit inscrutable. And you can in fact enter them and go and figure them out if you spend a huge amount of time, but you've got to invest in all. I don't know exactly where I'm going with this. I guess I think there's some real truth to this, and that Trump is a particularly weird figure who is in many ways a product of a lot of like online cultural weirdness that has like the way of online, just the way that like online culture has developed over the past 15 years. And that there's a bunch of people out there who think that like that's the way you can tell right now that he's going to win. Again, I want to be clear, I do not endorse that theory necessarily. I think there is something true to the fact that he's going to win, or that like the vibes are like so totally Trump. I'm not even on TikTok, so I don't see this stuff, but it does seem like there's something there to me.
I guess what I'm always kind of curious about is how new is any of this, right?
Yeah, so like that's a great question. Absolutely.
Like what we're talking about here, is a new, it's just a new variety of partisanship in a way, right? Like I was thinking of the movie Gangs of New York the other day. Gangs of New York is essentially, right, like we talk about the gangs of New York, but really like it's a political struggle that movie is between the Know-Nothings and the, you know.
Well, ethnic and political as well, yeah. Ethnic, political, religious, yeah.
And that is, and again, that's like, that is a hyper weird version of that, ending in, you know, a massive gang war in the middle of New York City amidst draft riots and everything. But it is still at heart, it was still like kind of a weirdly intense partisan political dispute. And I do think that, this sort of thing has been fairly common in American history. It's just that we now have a slightly different and more intense and more nichified version of it in the age of the internet. We're running long here, so maybe we should wrap up. But I don't know. I mean, do you guys think that this is just the latest iteration of the same thing?
I don't know. It feels different to me. Both because it's so personality driven, because it's a consumption experience to a certain extent. And maybe that's one way to draw a distinction between sort of fandom and simple partisanship, or even sort of ethnic or religious loyalty, is that it's a consumer experience to a certain extent, right? And like the way Trump talks about his rallies, he's like, they want a show, right? He understands himself as someone who's putting on a performance and selling merch, whether that's like NFTs or gold sneakers. And so I do think there is sort of like a, maybe the way you define fandom is, you know, in enthusiasm for a cultural experience that you pay for, in which case I do think politics is becoming more like cultural fandom as it's understood. I don't know. Maybe that's a bad way to put it.
I think there's a history of fandom and politics intersecting, but that the intensity, the scale of it is different here. And this is, it's not that we've never seen these dynamics before in politics. It's not that we've never seen fan culture act the way that it acts now, and with its obsessions and factions. I mean, go back to some of the science fiction clubs in the early days of science fiction, and you will see that those folks would sort of organize and then split and over politics or whatever. There is definitely some historical precedent here. At the same time, to see this in the presidential race, to see this sweeping this many millions of people in the country, and to be expressed at this scale, I think that is a little bit new.
Yeah. All right. Let me exit question here. Do we think, so is Alan Moore right to pin the rise of Trump on toxic fandom, or is Trump himself more the cause of toxic fandom here? I mean, he points to Boris Johnson as well, but I do think that, I mean, I don't know, maybe it's just because I didn't live in England at the time, but I do think that Trump is a different version of a similar thing, certainly on an intensity level, than Boris Johnson.
I think Trump is a malign and brilliant cultural entrepreneur whose fandom is toxic.
Peter?
I think that both things are true. Trump has experience wielding and organizing fandom going back years with, you know, just with the WWE, if nothing else. He's also just very good at getting the media, and in particular the New York media, to pay attention to him. That has been a huge part of his life for as long as he has been a public figure. I also think that the moment is ripe for to exploit a kind of fandom at scale that wasn't possible in 1985 or probably in 1995. And one of the reasons why is because of the internet.
I honestly don't know. I'm fascinated by this question, because I do think that Trump is sui generis, but is also working within a system that has encouraged this sort of thing for a long time. And it is kind of hard to disambiguate the two. So I'm going to dodge my own exit question. That's how I roll. All right. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus this Friday for a bonus episode. I think we're going to be talking about election movies, maybe. We'll see. Whatever we do, it'll end up being fun. Be there. Be square. I don't know. Now on to the main event. Venom, The Last Dance. Tom Hardy returns as Eddie Brock / Venom, the disgraced reporter who has bonded with symbiotic alien goo and gained superpowers in the process. This is the third movie in the, Venom trilogy. It's a sequence of films with no real thematic through line or deeper resonance beyond, hey, Tom Hardy seems to be having fun doing silly voices. But we call it a trilogy because all three movie sets of films are trilogies now. That's just how it works. Anyway, if you remember anything from the first two films, congratulations, I guess. I don't remember very much, but the only thing you really need to know is that Stephen Graham played a detective, and he shows up for a few minutes in a small but pivotal role, I guess, in this one. But even if you don't remember who he was, or really who Eddie is, or who Venom is, or what any of this stuff is, it doesn't really matter. None of this really matters. You're not here for the plot. You're here for Tom Hardy and silly voices. That's why you're here. There is a plot. I can assure you it's ridiculously muddled and besides the point. Three times the film informs us that there is a character named Null. This character exists. He is the creator of the alien symbiotes like Venom, I guess. And he can only be released from the prison he finds himself in if he obtains a codex, which is for some reason created when a symbiote saves the life of the person he has bonded with. It's the most ridiculous MacGuffin of all time. They might as well have just called it a MacGuffin. They might as well have said, we need the MacGuffin to release Null. That would have been, maybe would have made more sense. Anyway, I feel dumber having typed all of this out, particularly since... And here's a spoiler, I guess. There will be some spoilers in this talk. Null actually never shows up in the movie except from his prison. He's like teased the whole way through. He's going to be released and he's going to wreak vengeance upon the universe. He's hinted repeatedly at being this major heavy, you know, and maybe he is. I don't know. I'm not familiar enough with Venom lore to know if he's like Thanos or whatever, but seems like a bad dude. But he doesn't show up. He doesn't show up in the movie. It's like, hey, Null's coming. Null's going to get out of jail. He's going to come do bad things. Then it doesn't happen. I don't understand why you would tease a major villain in the third and supposedly final iteration of this series of films. It doesn't make any sense. Nothing in this film makes any sense, and that's fine. It doesn't really matter that much. The plot is just an excuse to have Tom Hardy run around doing funny voices. He likes doing his funny voices. And I kind of act like he's a schizophrenic at war with himself. If you watch Venom The Last Dance solely on that level, you'll be fine with it, I guess. You might enjoy it. I don't know. I don't hate these movies, even though none of them is particularly good, because they're all more or less watchable because Tom Hardy is very good at his job, which is being an actor and being kind of interesting on screen. That said, not many people seem to be watching this. Like many other recent comic book movies, Venom The Last Dance has severely underperformed. It grossed way less than the $70 million opening it was projected for this weekend. You know, between It, Joker 2, Madame Web, and Morbius. A lot of Sony Spider-Verse movies in there getting tossed around, it should be noted. It's getting harder and harder to argue that there isn't some level of comic book movie fatigue setting in. And yeah, I know Deadpool and Wolverine is one of the highest grossing movies of the year. That's fine. That sort of success is quickly becoming the exception rather than the rule. Peter, if comic book movies are in fact receding in importance, does that mean that the audience is finally growing up? Is Alan Moore going to get his wish for a, you know, an advanced audience?
I don't think the audience is growing up. I think the audience is getting tired and just staying home. And that's a big difference, because it's not just that comic book movies are doing badly. It's that the box office is kind of down overall, partly because there are fewer films, but it's just clearer than ever that viewers do not have the muscle memory of going to the movie theater. And we're seeing that with things that should be tent poles, should be holding up a month of box office grosses, like Venom 3 here. And I mean, arguably Joker 2, although Joker Folie à Deux was such an anti-movie in some ways, and just sort of almost designed to repel people who liked the first one, that it's a little bit of a different scenario. This is Venom: The Last Dance is designed to give people who liked the previous two Venom films more of the same. If anything, this is the one of the three that I dislike the least. And the reason is because it's the least serious, the most campy, and the most tonally consistent. It's not a good movie by any means. This is a bad movie. I want to be clear. Don't take this as a recommendation. But the first two really struggled with tone. The first one in particular wanted to, in some ways, be this kind of dark sci-fi movie about an anti-hero villain type who was really maybe horrible, gross, but like did in fact do some, you know, to fight the bad guy in the end. And then the second, but there were like these, a couple of scenes in the first movie where it was like, oh, wait, this is a goofy, crazy comedy about a guy whose brain is being taken over by a symbiote. And the second movie, they were like, more of that, but still Venom eating heads off of things. And like, and this movie, like, yeah, sure, we get some head eating at the beginning with like some cartel bad guys. But this is just 100% camp buddy comedy. Frankly, it borders on a rom-com. Like, this might be the best rom-com I've seen in theaters in 2024, which is not to say, again, that it's good, but it's better than any of the others. Maybe it's the only rom-com I've seen in 2024 in a movie theater. I couldn't bring myself to hate this movie in the way that I really quite disliked the first two. And that's just because it doesn't try to do anything really at all, except let Tom Hardy loose as Venom and be a goofball with himself. There's a Venom horse and a Venom frog and a Venom fish. Like, I think you could have taken a bunch of these gags and made them smarter and funnier and more elaborate and more over the top. As I said to Alyssa over the weekend, I think this movie would have been much better if you'd had James Gunn direct it. James Gunn, who really has just a much more fine-tuned sense of like how to draw out comedy and but also something a little more than that from freakish cartoon, you know, comic book characters. But if you like the first two Venom films and you especially liked the funny bits, you'll probably enjoy this. It's a bunch of funny bits, I guess, strung together.
I feel like we're both struggling with this movie in the same way, because it really has defeated at least my critical sensibilities, because it's like, well, look, it's not good. It's obviously not good.
It's definitely not good.
It more or less succeeds at what it's trying to do, which is to be a one-man hangout movie. I mean, that's really what this movie is. It's a one, yeah. It's like Tom Hardy. Like, remember, right. the first two films have, like, Eddie Brock has a love interest, and he's trying to show that he's a fit person for human companionship, and the symbiote is kind of helping him with that, in addition to killing criminals and eating their brains or whatever. And like there was at least some idea of a forward momentum for this plot. And this movie really is just like, Tom Hardy wanted to be by himself on screen as much as possible and do funny things by himself. Sometimes with animals. Sometimes
Venom horse.
Sometimes there's you know, a CGI monster he's got to run away from. But like, it really does feel, it's like almost, it's a misanthropic hangout movie. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Does that make sense to you guys?
Yes. No, my husband and I actually have a disagreement about whether this is my husband's interpretation. Venom is a movie about how men are in such severe friendship crisis that like the best available option is to hang out with an alien symbiote, let it just colonize your brain. Or whether it's a movie about how immigrants are good, and like the immigrants are good sort of cheesy subplot of this movie is like, very, very funny. Like, Venom's whole desire is to, like, go to New York and see the Statue of Liberty. And, like, you know, the alien symbiotes who are being demonized by the military in the person of Chiwetel Ejiofor's character, whose name I don't know, Strickland, maybe, something, whatever, the Imperium program, blah, blah, blah. They're like these alien invaders from outer space. They're bad. But actually, when push comes to shove, the alien invaders show up and are like, no, we're going to fight on the side of the humans. Like, we're going to, you know, culturally assimilate. It's literally a movie about assimilating into American society.
But Alyssa, I have to stop you there for a second, because I've seen all three of these movies, and in the first one, there are a bunch of other aliens who come to the planet and they do cause lots of chaos and damage. They are trying to take over they're trying to kill Venom.
I haven't seen the first two of these movies, so I feel like I'm liberated to just sort of enjoy its dumb goofiness. Like,
this is the ideal way to have seen this, probably.
I feel like the recent lesson of this podcast is, like, not having seen movies actually makes me, like, a more joyful critic.
No, I more joyful, yes, but I do think, like, to be a critic, you kind of need to watch movies. No, yes, you don't need to have seen the first two of these. I want to be really clear, especially you.
You really don't, is the thing. And that's, like, that's the thing I find most fascinating about the description of this as a trilogy of films. Like, I'm sorry, there is no connection between any of these movies except that there is a character who is named Venom in all three of them. Like, that's really it. There's a Venom and an Eddie Brock. That's about it.
And there's a whole thing about, like, Venom and Eddie hanging out with their landlady from the previous movies that I apparently missed.
Yes. She's nice. She dances. They dance to ABBA in this
movie. Okay. All right. I guess that's the thing that happens.
I got to say, the thing that's least realistic about this movie, and I say this as somebody who recently has been to the Paris Hotel in Las Vegas, there's a moment in this movie where Eddie tries to enter the casino and he's wearing a t-shirt and shorts and, like, a party shirt, you know, like a Hawaiian shirt or something. And the guy's like, sorry, you can't come in here. We have a dress code at the Paris Hotel.
Yeah,
I can assure you that is nonsense. You could show up there wearing a tank top and a pair of swim trunks. They'd be like, all right, come on in. Just give us your money and you can gamble. That's fine. This movie doesn't understand how Las Vegas works.
So it's a false advertising?
What this movie gets
wrong. It's definitely a bizarre scene to imply that specifically the Paris Hotel has a dress code. I myself have walked through the casino floor literally in swim trunks and a tank top because I've had to stay there a couple of times for conferences. And, like, there's a pool, and sometimes you go to the pool. It's like I was just like, what? They're going to make him wear a tux? I mean, it's a funny gag to get him into a tux.
It's not like it's, you know, the Wynn or whatever. Like, it's not a nice casino. I've been to the Paris Hotel a lot of times. It's pretty, it's fine. It's perfectly acceptable, but it's not, you know, a high class establishment. So the owner of the Paris Hotel is going to yell at us now, probably.
That is actually a pretty good review of Venom 3. It's perfectly fine, but it's not a high class establishment.
Is it perfectly fine? I just don't think it's one of these things where, again, I don't know how to review this because my overriding critical principle is, like, if a movie succeeds at what it's trying to do, that counts for a lot. And I think this movie does succeed at what it's trying to do. It's just that what it's trying to do is really dumb.
It's not just that what it's trying to do is really dumb, though that is correct. It's that it's trying to be trashy. There is an intentional trashiness to this. And that is why I didn't hate it as much as the previous two films, because those two films at times felt like they were reaching for something more. This movie is never reaching for anything more than what it is. And what it is dumb and trashy, but it's just that. And if you like the dumb and trashy elements of the first two Venom films, you'll probably enjoy this one enough. I wouldn't rush out to the theater for it, though, despite my theater boosterism. I would wait to watch this one on streaming.
It'll be on Netflix Pay One soon enough. I don't know.
Very late at night when you can't sleep.
Yeah.
Best time to watch anything.
I don't feel like we need to waste any more time on Venom 3. Alyssa, thumbs up or thumbs down on Venom, The Last Dance?
I mean, thumbs, like, marginally up under the circumstances Peter described.
Wow, look at this. Peter.
I have to give it a thumbs down, but I'm very excited about the Null spinoff film, which they've been promising us.
I also have to give it a thumbs down, even though, again, it's like, it's not unwatchable. I've seen worse movies. I enjoy seeing Tom Hardy on the big screen. He's a great deal of fun. He's clearly having a lot of fun here. I just, it's not good. It's not, it's, I demand more of Tom Hardy, I guess. I don't know. Whatever. All right, that's it for today's show. Many thanks to our producer, Sebastian Hughes, without whom this program would sound much worse. Make sure to swing by Bulwark Plus on Friday for our bonus episode. Tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SundayMunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys on Friday.